And there was a tanker there, and they did him, and he just went up like nothing. Lightning, the other ship's not to tell. He was lying stern to the wall this way, at right angle to him. And so he said, the hell with this, I'll get out of here. He went full ahead with his anchor down. And he came back, and his whole side was just covered with black and oil from this tank, because the oil went all over the water, and it was gaily ablaze. And so we had fire on the water for a whole day after. There was very little tide there. And at night was just as light as day. So these raids went on. The Germans were really going after this supply base in a big way. And there was nothing they could do but just stick it out. I think they hit 11 ships during that 5 days. Hmm. Another interesting thing was that it was all, and it became increasingly so, hard to get spare parts out there, you know. So whenever a ship was hit, the first question was, have you got to go back? And if the answer was yes, why then, way scavenging party. And Ajax, who was a cruiser, she just done a big refit in the States, you know, been there for, I don't know how long, come out, all new equipment, everything fancy, and I guess it was the second day Ajax was hit by a bomb, went through his engine room, damaged all his machinery on the port side, and so he had to go back. Well, I know, we were over there like ghouls. Stripping the stuff off.
And what in the in a case like that, what happened? The captain wrote it off to war damage or something? And
it was acceptable. You know, I transferred stores for supply, and they never accounted for it with no time.
Anymore. Yeah.
It was a funny little minefielder on Albacore. He was sitting just across from us. And our loud hailer had gone. And the Albacore, it was quite shallow in the harbor. And the Albacore was hit, and he sank, just settled on the bottom. So I was away in the boat, you know, while the raid was still going on to get in loud air. But it was grim.
Whatever happened to the merchant ship with the bomb and
the old Torp, he got the bomb out. He got a DSC hook. And
he took it out.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
He defused it and took it out of the ship.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, and also during that thing, they dropped circling torpedoes in the harbor. I'd never run into these before either, but these are quite common in the middle of the town. They drop a torpedo in the harbor, and the torpedo drops. They'd be looking over, see the torpedo, because the water's quite clear and calm, and you'd see these torpedoes going around in circles. They usually hit the putty, very rarely.
I can say, ever decreasing circles or ever enlarging circles?
Ever enlarging circles.
Oh, yeah.
So that was our introduction to this gallant port. And it was a strenuous 5 days, I can tell you. But however, after that, things sort of quietened down, and they began to get more fighters there. They had an aerodrome set up just between Bona and Constantine. Constantine was on the desert, about 50 miles south of Bona. So things got a bit easier on the air raid business. And so I guess it was about the middle of January that we went out to do our first sweep in the Straits, which was our primary task. The ships have been doing it before, but this is the first time we were on the spacecraft. I better explain this. It's called the Narrows of the Mediterranean, and from the North African coast, and it was from Bona over to Sardinia, is about 70 miles, actually. So the Germans were in Sardinia, and you can see how close the airplanes were. That's the sort of problem.
No difference at all. Yeah.
And the tip of Sicily, that Isolde de Maritimo, which is a little island off the end of Sicily, western end of Sicily, was about 70 miles that way. It was about 50 miles across from Sicily to Bizerta, you know, in Tunis. But the problem was that the water was very shallow on the southern side, around Bizerta and Tunis, the Bay of Tunis. And it was under 100 fathoms, so it was all someone with mines. And the Germans, of course, were going to the east of this line across to the ports like Augusta and Syracuse in Sicily. So in order to get into that area, we have to go around the minefield that was up and quite close to the Sicilian coast. The deep water was quite close to the Sicilian coast. So it meant that the enemy practically always knew you were there. We had aircraft during surveillance of the straits, and so they usually told us when these ships were going. So it was a bit of a game of who got there first and who survived the exercise. It was what we call sink at sight. There was no challenge or anything like that. You shot at everything. And we always went in company. Sometimes there were four, but sometimes two.
I take it, though, that your main opponent was the Air Force, not circus ships.
Oh, practically all, yeah. So the Italian fleet was really no problem.
Yeah.
And submarines were not much of a problem in the Med at that time, although they were becoming increasingly so. I think there were about 17 German submarines in the Med at that time. But we didn't really run into the submarine problem, but you couldn't go anywhere. Some guy said when he was blowing out his life belt, this is the only air support you get today. But it was true that the Spitz gave us air support during the daytime, and they could fly out to about 50 miles from the coast. So our trek was to sail from Bone 2 hours before sunset. And we would get the Spitfires for our fighter cap until dark. And then we were on our own. And we had to get out and do what we were going to do and get back within, 50 miles of Bone by dawn, my first flight. Mm-hmm. And so everything was done at very high speed. And I'll mention this here, they provided us, and this is the first time I ran into this, in the fighter aircraft, they had little communication, VHF communication sets, and they had little push buttons, and you could change channels. There were four buttons on those sets that we had. They were really aircraft sets we had, and they had a funny little antenna up at the top of the mast. You could push these buttons and put it on the right channel, and most of the time you could talk to airplanes that were on the same crystal, where they were all crystal sets, so as long as you're on the same crystal, they're okay. As the number of aircraft in the Med increased, the number of channels increased, and we never were on the right crystals, except for the people that were assigned to us. So we talked to our chummy fellow in the air. Now, we had radar by this time. We had both search radar, which gave us radar warning of aircraft, and we also had gunnery control radar. 285. So we could provide some warning. We had no plot system to actually control the fighters, but we could provide them with information. And so it was a sort of a lash-up arrangement, but it was called informative fighter control, and there was a link between the two. Strange enough, I was talking to one of the guys one day, and I listened to him, and I said, gee, are you a Canadian? And he says, yeah. I said, who are you? And maybe one of my classmates from RNC. No, okay. Bud Connell.
I was going to say.
Certainly, yeah. So I talked into, I managed this thing myself. It was right on the bridge, and that was the way to work it. Anyway, off we went on these sweeps. And you rush up, and as you went by Cape Maritimo, we had things called headache sets, which detected enemy's radio and radar frequencies. And you could see this enemy radar on our own radar. Quite frequently, it would blank us out on that side. I don't think it was done intentionally to blank us out. It just mm-hmm. was powerful. Mm-hmm. So you knew you were detected. And so the first run out, we went, there was one merchant ship, and an escort with this thing, and we picked them up on radar. There were just two of us this time, myself and I think it was Loyal. And we were using flashless cordite. So you just shoot, and we left the ship on fire, and then get out, so, and rush back, get back within your fire. And this is the game that was playing. And it was a tiring sort of exercise, because you left at, you know, by the time you got ready to sail, I mean, you were up and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you got back about 9 or 10 in the morning, up all night, and going like hell. The only thing is, the weather usually was pretty good.
They had very small convoys, and they were shipping across.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
One, two or three ships, something?
Yeah, sometimes. I think the largest that we ever got in that game was 4 or 5.
Hmm.
No, they just sailed them individually. In fact, I suppose it was probably made sense from that. But there was a direct correlation between the progress along the North African coast and the volume of shipping that just sank across there, if you'll... You know, in hindsight, reading Rommel's stories about his supply problem. It also was related to, you know, how the supplies were getting around to the Eighth Army around the Cape.
Yeah.
If you analyze it, you'll find there's a 6-month delay, but there's a very definite relationship between the way the supplies went both on both sides. And this was what this force was doing. Now, I guess it must have been... The second time we were up, Lightning was with us anyway. There were only 2 of us. And we got 2 ships that night. And this was in March, if I remember rightly. But they were escorted by E-boats. And this was the first time we ran into these German motor torpedoes, very fast, small boats carrying torpedoes. And they hit Lightning with a torpedo. And Lightning was, you know, we were doing full speed, 35 knots. And so the ship just filled with water and sank pretty quickly. We got quite a we picked up quite a number. But it was a good ship, and we were sorry to lose it. Funny enough, there were a lot of jellyfish in the water, and a lot of people suffered from stings.
Stings
from jellyfish,
yeah.
Huh. Very unusual. Now this business of sweeps, we never knew when they would occur, so we were always ready to go, and of course, equally well, we never knew when we were going to an air raid. So, you were living pretty frequently on board the ship. It wasn't any time off. We would go back occasionally to Algiers to fuel. We'd take an empty convoy back and bring one back up again and rotate. One interesting sidelight, there were some British MTBs operating in the Straits in the same way, sort of. And one of the commanders, or the CO, one of these MTBs, was Corny Burke, the fellow
over here
in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Corny was a very unorthodox Canadian in Dee's mind. Corny come roaring up with his big MTB, and the main thing they wanted was water. And so he'd go, whoomp, 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 while we were tied up alongside there in the bones. And he'd sing up to me, Charles, I need some water. He never talked.
Never talked to the captain, eh?
He took a dim view of Canadians this time.
He went to buy the message on the view.
But Corny had met some local... They didn't used to use Bowen because it was a bad place for them. They were around the corner or in the bay there. And he met a local French family, Coulons, I think they call them. Anyway, they had an old Citroën. And so we'd go and have, on 2 or 3 occasions, I guess, I went and had a meal with this family. The food was delightful. And then we'd go down and sit on the beach, or we'd go and sit on Cordy's private yacht. Drink the local Algerian vino and enjoy the Mediterranean spring.
I suppose he's over that thing around like a bit of a yacht.
Yeah,
he wasn't
on
operations. He appeared, some book or other he appeared written about the MTBs in the Mediterranean. He appeared in it, I know, a number of times. Read it many years ago.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
There were a couple other things happened while we were there. This must have been in February, I guess. We went back to have another session. We went back to fuel. And my status went up with D quite a bit because we were missing a radar part. G and the 285 wasn't working. So we went into Algiers, and Rodney was there, part of Portage. And Johnny Andras, this fellow who had been in Restigouche with me, was the second gunnery officer in Rodney. And the radar officer was Terry Burchill, a Canadian. So I skittled over to see these genial fellows, and Dee said, where are you going? I think I'm going to see my friend. But I came back with the radar bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I said the radar officer had run near the Canadian, so we were back in business.
And back in the captain's good graces.
Yeah. Yeah, we went up and down like a yo-yo. We then took Fort H back to Gibraltar, and nothing untoward happened. By that time, I was beginning to get a feel for the problem. And we were told to take a convoy from Gib to Algiers, a slow convoy. And this was when the Canadian corvette came in. And there were eight of them, I guess, at Gib. Or they came in with these convoy, and they came in to Gib the fuel. And we were to join the convoy as the AA people, and of course, again, we were senior officers of the escort. So Dee sent me over to see the senior officer of the corvette who came in. It was Louis Berg, Simon Louis Berg. And I went over, and I was delighted to see these fellows. Again, I was a bit skeptical about corvettes in the men, because they had no AA thing, and that was sure as hell what we'd been faced with all the time. But there had been a certain amount of submarine thing. And I told the people there, I got all the COs of the corvettes, and I told them what it was like and mad and what the problems were. I warned them about the torpedo bombers. And we sailed that afternoon. Went out, and I guess it was about midnight. It was a clear, calm, lovely night. You're enjoying everything, and then in came the airplane. And they were Italian torpedo bombers, and the torpedoes ran across. One went right across our bow. Louis Berg was on the next ship to us in the screen because he was a senior officer of the Canadian escort, and the torpedo just hit him, and he sank like a stone. That was a bit of a shock.
Because the torpedo is one of those ships.
Strange enough, when they got to Algiers, they were running these short convoys up the coast, and they sank two submarines within about 3 or 4 days, and that was better than the RN had done for months. But they didn't stay keep them there very long. I think they were, they couldn't have been there anymore, 3 or 4 months, I guess.
It must have been in shallow waters there, of course. It must have... Seemed like good hunting to the torpedoes, because they
It was not a good place for submarines. No. That's right. Yeah. And these fellows were all experienced AS fellows, whereas, indeed, we did very little anti-submarine business, really. So, the debate of whether it was a sensible thing to send the corvettes in there or not, I think also there must have been some sort of political thing to get the RCM in the fray, sort of business. And I think they did very well under the circumstances, but they certainly weren't the right type of ship to send there.
Were there any survivors to Louis Berg?
Very few. So back we went to Bone, and I guess it was somewhere in March. We went out one night, and we had Tartar with us. And We had been told there was merchant ships out there, but we just saw a single flash of light on the horizon. And so we went for it, pulled back, and suddenly we had 7 echoes on the radar. So we started shooting, going like Gulliver Dam, and I was down in the open bridge, the canopy extended up like that, and I had these little radio sets, and I used this VHF set that I used to talk to aircraft. I talked to Tiger. Now we do it all the time, but that was unusual in those days. And Dee would say, you tell him take the right, when we had a bunch of targets, it was called the distribution and control of gunfire. And that's the way we did it. You take the ones on the starboard side, I'll take the port, and then guns roll going right home.
And while I was down in there talking, there was a hell of a bang. And I said, oh, Jesus, you know, we've been hit by a torpedo. There were torpedoes going everywhere.
Well, you were under attack, aircraft attack, were you?
No, no, these were E-boats.
Oh, E-boats.
E-boats, yeah. Mm-hmm. These funny little echoes we picked up in the Sentinel. And there was a hell of a bang, and so I popped my head out to see what the hell had happened, and there was a half an E-boat going down each side of the ship.
Oh, for God.
I run right into it. Kind of have, we had deliberately done that. And we had sunk two, and we had another one on fire, and the two off were going off on the horizon of the high temp. So we started for home, and the engineer officer came up and said, we're taking water in the Four Peak. We better slow down. So we slowed down to about 15 knots, and they got all the shores out. You know what they do? They put in big shores, shored it off, and then we started working up on speed again. And the engineer officer came up, and he said, we can't go this fast. So we came down to, I think, about 24 knots. And he said he thought it would hold at that speed. Well, you know, old navigator was working out all about the calculations, and it became quite apparent we weren't going to get back. I don't know.
This air screen was such a short distance because the airfield was so far inland. Is that why they, you only had 50 miles?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I just wasn't quite sure about that, yeah.
It was also combined with the problem you were getting closer and closer to the enemy. You know, he could then put his fighters on the thing, and I am not a good one to describe the air problems of men, other than that I was continually having it explained to me, and this problem of ranges and the strength of the enemy versus our own, and radar control was a very important element in this. The Germans had radar control stations in Sicily. And so the closer our fighters went to it, well, then the German fighters then were using their radar control to fight out, you know, that sort of problem. So it was the same problem in Malta. Malta was close to Sicily. You know, and as long as the fighters around Malta were under the radar control of Malta, they had the advantage over the fighters, but the moment they went out, and it shifted the other way. There's those sort of problems in this thing, which you better get an airman to tell you about. But anyway, they were constantly with it because air was our biggest threat always, and it was a terribly important part in the game, except that at night we were fairly free. Anyway, in this case, we skittled back. It became clear we weren't going to get back. We sent a message saying that we would get as close as we could, and could we have the fighter cap, an extra fighter cap, first thing in the morning. And so Dee then sent a message to this fellow in charter, old Tom Turris, and he said, you proceed to Bone. And that's the first time I've ever seen anybody directly disobey an order. So he steamed around us, and we got along pretty heavily in the morning. If he'd have been sunk, he'd have been in a poor legal position.
Yes, he would have been. If he survived, he
got away with it. But Dee sent for him when we got an army, gave him out of hell for disobeying your order.
You actually made it all the same.
Yeah,
Maybe it was a good thing he stayed with you.
Well, I think that's probably so. That's probably so. And that's obviously his special situation. Then we had a damaged bow. So we had to go back to Algiers, and they put cement in the bow, which sort of slowed us down a little bit, not much. Now, let's recall what happened. By this stage of the game, things were beginning to advance with the Army, particularly 8th Army was coming this way pretty rapidly, and then the 1st Army began to move, and gradually the air raids eased off in the situation. And so in what was called the final stages of North Africa, they generated a thing called Operation Retribution, was called. And the idea was to put all the ships and all the airplanes out there to make sure there was no Dunkirk in reverse. and I can't remember the exact dates of this thing, but first of all, we painted all the ships. We used the red lead, you know, the stuff they used to come around. Mm-hmm. We painted all the ships red. It was called Retribution Red. And, this must have been early in May, I guess. You would have to look up the history when it actually happened. And we went out and ringed the North African coast with destroyers. 24 destroyers around there. And all we got was a message from old A.B. Cunningham.
Mm-hmm. What was the other you painted red? So you wouldn't
identify it with the aircraft.
By your own ship,
yeah.
Eh?
Always
your own plane.
Don't let any Huns get home. So, it was beautiful weather, you know, just flat, calm, clear nights and things like that. And we divided the destroyers up all the way around, right from Bazerte to around into the Bay of Sirte, around Cape Bon. We had to be careful of the mines, which was fun. And there were the odd boat that we picked up, but there really wasn't much. And then one night, I guess, I forget what night it was, there was a ship, quite a large ship, came out of Tunis, making a run for it. And we picked this fellow up and thanked him. And I don't know how many troops there were on board. I hate to say, obviously over 1,000, I should say. But we picked up 3 survivors from this ship and then steamed on, because you couldn't wait around. You didn't know what was going to happen. And the next day, while we were out there, we had our own fighter caps. We had our own Spitfire over. But then it was called the Northwest Africa Tactical Air Force or something. This is Chewy Spat, right, this organization from Algiers. They were also had their airplanes up there looking for enemy people, too. This is why we'd all been painted red, because everybody was trying to shoot something.
Yeah.
And while we were steaming around with our own Spits over top, suddenly a whole host of Spitfire came screaming out of the sky and started bombing Bister, which was one of the destroyers next to us in the line. And we could hear them on the RT, and these were American flying Spitfires. I don't know how that came about, but anyway, that's what they were. And we tried to tell our cap to tell these guys to stop bombing their own ship. But in any event, they hit Bister with a 500-pound bomb, and they slowed him down, and he was taking water, but he could still move. The closest port at that time where we were was the port of Tunis. And we'd heard over the BBC news that Tunis was now in our hands. And this revealed one of our problems quite quickly, too. We never knew where the hell the army was in the system. It was very hard to find out. So, Dee got, and one of these survivors that we picked up from this merchant ship that we sunk the night before was the third mate of the ship. And he came up on the bridge. All he had was a towel around his waist. And he said, I'll give you 2 minutes to lay off the track on that chart into Tunis through the minefield. Except he was the sort of guy that didn't leave any doubt in anybody's mind about what he was going to do about it.
Yeah.
So the fellow, he laid off the track. And it ran quite close to the eastern shore of the Bay of Tunis, which was still in the enemy's hands. So Dee took the German and put him right up in the bows of the ship, so if we hit a mine, he was the one that was going to go flipping anyway. You know, and the German understood that. Everybody understood the situation.
There was no doubt.
Yeah. It was in the German's interest to make sure that we didn't run into the minefield. That was fair enough. But as we started in with Bister behind us, going slowly, and we were only doing about 12, 14 knots again, we came under fire from an 88-millimeter battery over on the flat. Well, fortunately, then that part is sandy, you know, clear, and we could see the battery, and so we dealt with that, and the guns were firing, and the German was quite calm in the whole thing. He wasn't disturbed by that at all. Not that was part of the deal, I guess. But when we got in a bit further, we could see there were Free French troops involved. And we could see the tricolor flying in Tunis, but we could also see tanks and all sorts of people running around. And we had told CNC Med, David Gunning, that this is what we were doing with Bister. And suddenly we got a frantic message from him saying, Tunis is not in our hands. Take Bister around the Sousse, which is around the corner. So at this stage of the game, we were in the channel the guy had laid off. But we had to turn. And the minute we turned out of the channel, the Germans started jumping up and down on the boat and saying, hey, not part of the deal.
Yeah.
And he lost his towel in the middle of it. Yeah, I just still think of this day, this naked German jumping up and down objecting. The AS officer was down in what we call the Asdic hut listening, and you could hear these damn mines coming back on the ping reset. But somehow we got round back in the channel and came back and took Bister back around the And when we got back in the channel, I brought the German up off the forecastle. He didn't apologize to him, but he just said there's been a change in plan.
I guess. I don't know if people ashore must have thought seeing a naked man on the forecastle. Crazy British, eh?
So very funny, eh?
Yeah.
Well, later on, it was the next day, I guess. We got Bister around the suit, and we got back on patrol. It was the next day. There's a little island off Cape Bon. We were right off Cape Bon, which is the northeastern projection of Tunis, Bay of Tunis. And it's called Plain Island. It's between Cape Bon and Pantelleria. And it's a flat coral, typical. It's rather like Malta, you know, sticks up out of the water about maybe 15, 20 feet. And a lighthouse on it. And it's about a quarter of a mile long, I guess. And there was a fellow down there waving a towel. So he said, well, you better go and see what he wants. So the first lieutenant and I and about 10 guys got in a motor cutter, and off we went for our landing party on Plain Island. And this fellow was an Italian sergeant, and he spoke English quite well. And he said, I surrender. And we said, well, that's fine. He said, all the Italians surrender. And we said, that's fine. How many are there? He said, oh, about 30. He said, the Germans don't surrender.
Ooh.
How many Germans are there? Oh, about 40. Where are they? Up on the island, he said. So, old Kempton walked up the slope, or the sort of island rather flat on top, and then shelved down the water. He walked up and he bellowed out in English, you know, the Germans say, you better surrender. And so we suddenly had rifle bullets whistling around. You know, I wasn't by my game at all. You know, in the wrong place. So he came down and we thought about it for a minute. I said, well, we'll send the Italian up. That was a much better idea. So we sent the Italian up and told him to tell the Germans that they might as well surrender, because otherwise we were just going to go back to the ship and, you know, lambast the place. So eventually, in rather straggly groups, the Germans came out of their potholes and surrendered. Now, the reason the Italian had surrendered, as I understand it, because we didn't know they were on the island, was that the Germans had taken over the lighthouse. They were using the lighthouse as their accommodation, and they left the tabs out in the cold. And the only food they had was Cadbury's milk chocolate, which they captured from the Eighth Army about an hour months before. And the Germans weren't sharing this with the Italians. So that wasn't fair shake, and this was why the Italians surrendered. One interesting thing
was... What was the name of this island you captured?
Plain Island. P-L-A-N-E.
Oh.
Just off Cape Bon. One of the... Of course, we searched these shadows, and one of them was a colonel in the Africa Pay Corps. And he had a money belt on his wrist, and there was about 1 million Tunisian francs in this money belt. Well, I don't know whether it was the thought well, the Tunisian Franks are no damn good anyway. Or whether we were just honest or gullible, I don't know. Anyway, we turned it in. But we found out that Tunisian Franks were perfectly good tender in Algiers afterwards.
What was this bird doing on that? He was just trying to escape.
They were all trying to get back to Sicily.
Yeah.
This was what the Germans and the Italians were trying to do, and this was what we were trying to prevent. And in the final analysis, very, very few of them did get back. Very few indeed. When we went back to Bonn after this was over, and again, I can't remember the dates, but you can find out in the history. There were thousands of prisoners. I've never seen so many, And they were loading them in ships to take them back to mostly North America. And the Germans were objecting to that highly. They figured they'd all be sunk on the way home. And in the end, I think only one prisoner of war ship was torpedoed. But gee, there were no guards. They had a few odd fellows around, but there were literally thousands of prisoners on the camp. It wasn't even a problem what to do with them. To feed them along was a problem.
Did you take these 30 and 40 people back yourself to...
Yes, we did, yeah.
To Bonn?
We went back to Bonn, I think. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we went back to Bonn because we had a parade victoire. Everybody turned out, and suddenly out of the desert appeared all the pre-French troops, the Zouaves and the Boons and the Spahis.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a great day. So that was the end of that schmoddle, and we went back to Algiers, because we had been selected, the king had come to Algiers. This was in April. It was about April 12th or 14th, I can't remember exactly when. We had been selected as a destroyer which was representing the destroyers in the Met, and the king came out and inspected the various ships. So this was the first time I personally met the king when he came on board then on June. But we weren't there very long, and we got, at that time, the orders for the landing in Sicily. Now, this is the first lot of these operation orders that I had seen. And they were vile. And if you'll recall, there was a great debate. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but there was a great debate about the number of troops that were going to land in the eastern section and whether the Americans would go to Palermo. So the orders we got, which was in April, early May anyway, because the landing wasn't until July, there were thousands of amendments to be done. And because of the security of it at that time, only the navigator and the captain and I knew about these orders. And that meant that the navigator and I were the guys who had to do all the amendments. It was during this time also that I intended, as a signal officer to the captain, I usually went along the conferences, so I attended two conferences up at headquarters in Algiers at that time about this subject, and this whole question was being debated of reallocation of forces and who was to command what and what. And during the time I met Harry Butcher, Eisenhower's press aide, who I eventually ran into a bit later down here in Santa Barbara. But Algiers was a very confused place. We didn't like it at all. Masses of troops that were there, and there was a real discipline problem to start with. The headquarters, although I was impressed by the staff that worked there, there were obviously real problems, policy problems which were occurring, and which became apparent in attending these meetings. and time became very short. But anyway, we also got orders for the landings in Pantelleria, mm-hmm. or the taking of Pantelleria. There was a lot of debate about this subject as to whether it was necessary to take it. Pantelleria was an Italian-held island between Cape Bon and Malta. But in my mind, the overriding argument was that it provided an air strip, and that was in all of our minds, terribly important. So off we went, and again, I can remember the date here. I got a newspaper clipping on this thing. It was called Operation Corkscrew, and it was the taking of Pantelleria. So we first went there. There were four cruisers and about eight destroyers, and we did a preliminary bombardment, which we did at night, and we banged away at the port in sort of a softening up process. And then the actual landing took place on, I think it was June the 10th. And I can't remember where the troops came. We were, and this was the first time we began to get involved in this, in what we called close inshore support from the soldiers. And touchdown was, of course, at first light in the morning. And so it's... while the landing craft were on the way in, why then we were bombarding right on the beaches, and the bombers were dropping bombs on the place, and the troops went in, and very shortly after they hit the beach, we got a message on 500 KCs saying, beg to surrender due to the shortage of water. Well, I suppose that last part was valid in the sense that it's a very dry island, and this was, you know, in the summer, Mediterranean summer. And the bombers, these were fortresses type, were dropping these bombs, and the place was just erupting in dust. It was quite impressive, so I never seen bombs like that. It looked as though the whole island, it was rather like Mount St. Helens, right? You know, essentially, went up in dust. Well, when we got this message to surrender, we all stopped firing. And this is where the controversy arose. The problem was, the bombers, of course, had all left their bases, and they couldn't, there didn't seem to be any means which to stop them. So they went on bombing for 4 hours.
These guys were trying to surrender, weren't
they? After they surrendered, and there were quite a number of civilians killed. So this was really what my view of the controversy. The decision to take the island was right. It laid on an operation which hadn't foreseen, I guess, this sort of thing, and there wasn't any way to stop it.
Well, there was no liaison between in some way there.
Well, the message, you know, they knew in headquarters that the island surrendered. We got cleared that back to Algiers very quickly, but getting the message to the down to the squadrons of the bombers who were in the air, I think, was the problem. We got a bit better at this later on, but not all that good. But anyway, this was a good demonstration of the problem of laying on an operation and then not being able to
turn it off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they banged up that island for an additional 4 hours, which wasn't really necessary. Well, that... how's the time coming here? Just about time.
Oh, getting on. Another 5 minutes or so, I suppose we'll just about finish it out. Yeah.
Oh, well, there was one thing I missed. After this... before this Pantelleria thing, we were escort for the first convoy that went through the Med, you know, since the... it was called GTX-1, but in order to do that, we had 16 minesweepers ahead of us, sweeping these mines around Cape Bon. And again, the weather was just beautiful. And we were all sitting up there in the forecastle behind the minesweepers, and the ships were behind us. And we all had rifles. And the mines would pop up. Shooting at mines. And every once in a while, one would go out with a hell of a bag. We were awarded beers for everybody who blew up a mine. But having seen rather quite a number of nights, you know, never being able to do so, this was rather pleasant. And we weren't bothered by enemy aircraft, although we were still in Sicily at that time. So, I mentioned that. Well, after Pantelleria, we went to Malta. Force K at Bona disbanded, and we became part of Force Q in Malta. But at this stage of the game, of course, we were all preparing for the landing in Sicily, which certainly we knew about the Dutch base camp. Now, do you want to stop there, or do you want
to... Well, yeah, we might as well, I guess, and pick up on Sicily when next time, what happened from there, or your experiences in Malta. There's only a couple of more...
I'll just talk about Malta at the moment. Malta was very heavily bombed. And there were sunken ships in the harbor, and the port was pretty badly demolished. Strange enough, there weren't all that number of casualties, because it's sort of a sandstone type of thing, and there were lots of caves and places that they could gather in the sand. The sandstone absorbed the shock. Admittedly, there were people killed, and the ships were sunk, and they were suffering from lack of food. But other than that, the spirit was great. See, it was Sunday, and of course they were delighted now because the pressure was off. But it was a real rubble heap. You literally couldn't drive a car around anywhere. Like you had to walk everywhere, and you're always walking over rocks and stones.
In your book there, you had the bar chip from Malta.
Well, that was during the time that all the troops were assembling.
We better leave that till next week then.
What we'll do here is end at this stage of the game, which was the fall of Pantelleria, and then Husky started in July, but all of this great gathering of clans started in the first week in July. They began to move troops and landing craft into Malta, because quite a number of the troops went direct from Malta to Sicily in landing craft.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to, like the Canadians came all the way from the Great Britain.
And the people
from the Middle East came that way too. But there were a large number of troops, I think the 51st Highlanders, the people from the 8th Army, who were over in... But there were a large number of troops, I think the 51st Highlanders, the people from the 8th Army, who were over in Tunis area, Tripoli, came over to Malta in landing craft, and also the landing craft came over, and so they went right from Malta.
Right from there.
So this is how they ended up with an ever-growing number of soldiers and landing craft in Malta.
Presumably there wasn't too much enemy air activity at that time over Malta, then. They must have known considerably.
Well, I think... At the time, of course, we were all very concerned about the element of surprise. There was attempts, as you read afterwards, for deception, to go to Sardinia and Greece. I think the enemy probably was confused as to where... they were going to go.
I think we're about finished here now, so we'll have to pack it in for the day. Admiral Charles, okay?